To the Wednesday Dose of Dopey, the podcast on drugs, addiction, and dumb shit. And my name is Dave, and I figured it's time to have a Wednesday Dose of Dopey. We're coming off of Thanksgiving. I've developed a newfound appreciation for cheesecake. Linda bought a cheesecake with some kind of chocolate fudge and brownie topping. And I'm not supposed to like cheesecake. I've said for years that cheese is not a dessert. Cheese is a bagel topping. Cheese cannot be a dessert, and yet I find myself eating the cheesecake. In fact, for full disclosure, she bought some kind of bakery cookie that I also complained about. But when you dip the bakery cookie into the cheesecake and frosting, it creates a synergistic flood of flavor. And yeah, it's going to be hard. I had started running again. I had started getting ready for the Dopey Fitness Challenge. I know you guys love the Dopey Fitness Challenge. I had started running, and I brought my dog, and my dog doesn't know to run. She wants to play, and the dog kept grabbing at my leash, and I kept saying, "Winnie, come on, keep going." And we're doing this Couch to 5K app, and the Couch to 5K app is you walk for a minute and you run for a minute, that kind of thing. Maybe you walk for 5 minutes and then you run for a minute, then you walk for a minute, then you run for a minute the first day. And Winnie started grabbing the leash and going, and I kept saying, "No, no, no." And we kept running until finally she did it again. She got tangled up in the leash and I fell down running at night. And I ripped my pants and I skinned my knee and I hit the dog, smacked the dog. Not like hard, but I was so upset. I was so betrayed by this dog. And of course, that was like a week ago and I still feel guilty and trying to make it up to the dog. I don't know how long this experiment of putting something up every weekday is going to go, but I'm excited for week one. Now I'm going to quickly read you an email I got. Said, "What's up, Dave and the Dopey Nation? My name is Haley, and I'm from Mississippi. I've been listening to Dopey for a few years now. Though I've heard many amazing episodes with tons of crazy shit, your last two episodes were fucking awesome." And this is two episodes ago. "First, with Glynis, man, she really brought the Dopey. I appreciate how open and honest she was about some of the things us women go through during active addiction. Her story was totally relatable. Then the latest episode with Billy Strings, bless his heart. I know the pain of losing both parents. The pain of losing your mom is indescribable, especially when you're just trying to hold your shit together. Dave, you have this way of asking the right questions at exactly the right time, even if interrupting." And then she puts a little laughing, crying emoji. "I will send you some Dopey stories soon. I have tons, from homelessness to prison, all with a fucked up IV meth and every other drug addiction. Can't wait to hear the next episode. Stay strong, Dopey Nation, and fucking toodles for Chris, Haley." Thank you, Haley. You get socks or stickers of your choice for sending in the email. We need voicemails. We need to hear your voices telling your dopey stories. Send them in to dopeypodcast@gmail.com, especially with the with the extra releases, I need extra voicemails. So if you have a story or you want to just send in a message of how much you love the show or hate the show or think I'm a dick or think I'm great or whatever, that I abuse animals, whatever you want to say, please send in an email or a voicemail to dopeypodcast@gmail.com. And then there was something else. I had gotten on this kick of playing passages from the Miles Davis autobiography, and then I kind of forgot about it. But I had a few saved up, so I'm going to play a passage from the Miles Davis autobiography. And this, just to put it in context, is when he came home from Paris after having his heart broken by Juliet Greco.
I didn't mean to leave Irene stranded the way I did, but I was sick with a heroin habit and my dreams of the woman I wanted. And that's all I could think about. When you're doing heroin all the time, you really lose your desire to have sex with a woman. At least I did. But people like Bird seemed to want to have sex whether they were off heroin or shooting every day. It didn't seem to make a difference to them. I enjoyed having sex with Irene, like I enjoyed having Juliet. But after I got my habit, I didn't even think about having sex, and I didn't enjoy it when I did. The only thing I could think about was how I was going to cop me some more heroin. I wasn't shooting in my veins yet, but I was snorting as much as I could get my hands on. One day I was standing on this corner in Queens with my nose running and shit. I felt like I had a fever or a cold. This hustler friend of mine who called himself Matinee came up and asked what I had been doing. I told him I had been snorting heroin and coke and that I had been doing it every day, and on this particular day I hadn't gone into Manhattan where I used to cop the shit. Matinee looked at me like I was a fool and told me that I had a habit. What do you mean a habit? I said. Matinee told me, your nose is running, you got chills, you're weak. You got a motherfucking habit, nigga. Then he bought me some heroin in Queens. I never bought heroin in Queens. I snorted the stuff Matinee copped for me, and I felt just fine. My chills went away, my nose stopped running. I didn't feel weak no more. I continued my snorting, but when I saw Matinee again, he said, Miles, don't waste that little money on getting something to snort because you're still going to be sick. Go on and shoot it. Then you feel much better. That was the beginning of a 4-year horror show. After a while, I was driven to getting dope because I knew if I didn't get it, I was going to be sick. And when you got sick, it was like having the flu. Your nose would run, your joints would ache real bad. If you didn't shoot some heroin into your veins, pretty soon you would start to vomit. Ah, that shit was terrible. So I avoided being in that situation at all costs. When I first started shooting heroin, I shot up by myself. Then I started hanging out. Me, a tap dancer named Leroy, and a guy we called Laffy was copping up on 110th, 111th, 116th streets up in Harlem. We were hanging in bars like the Rio, the Diamond, Sterling's, Levant's Pool Hall, places like that. We were snorting coke along with heroin all day long. When I wasn't with Leroy, I was with either Sonny Rollins or Walter Bishop. And a little later on with Jackie McLean or maybe Philly Joe Jones, who was around then too. We buy $3 caps of heroin and shoot it up. We do 4 or 5 caps a day, according to how much money we have. We go over to Fat Girl's apartment in the Cambridge Hotel on 110th Street between 7th and Lenox, or sometimes to Walter Bishop's house to shoot up. We'd have to go to Bishop's house to get our works, our needles, and whatever we were using to tie our arms up with so we could pop or hit. Make the veins we were going to be shooting the dope into stand up so we could see them. Sometimes we get so high that we leave our works at Bishop's house. Then we go hang around Mittens and watch the tap dancers dueling each other. I love to look at and listen to tap dancers.
Who doesn't love to listen and look at tap dancers? And if you want to hear more of that, just go get the Miles Davis autobiography audiobook. And if you want to hear any of this stuff without inserted ads, you go to www.patreon.com/dopeypodcast. Patreon is the spot. There's tons of extra stuff. On Wednesdays at 9 in the morning, we do a recovery Zoom. This Saturday, we're doing the Patreon Zoom, which is all about the show. There's bonus videos. There's bonus content. There's music. There's going to be a lot of extra stuff on Patreon moving forward. And every new thing we put on the main feed will also be on the Patreon feed without ads. All right. So I'm glad you guys are here to listen. And today on the show, we have Instagram phenom, hysterical drug addict, Naughty God. Here is me and Naughty. All right. So we are recording with a budding junkie Instagram. Are you on TikTok too?
I am on TikTok.
A budding junkie and YouTube too?
Oh, yeah.
A budding junkie YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok star, the Naughty God, also known as Dakota. Welcome to the show.
What's up, David? Thanks so much for having me, man. I'm stoked to be here.
Yeah, man. You're friends with Jimmy Who MU.
Yeah, that's who initially kind of inspired me to make content. When I saw his reels, I saw it as a recovering addict and thought, that's something I could do, maybe, you know?
So you're from San Diego, and if anyone doesn't know what you look like, you are a young man with tattoos all over your body and your face, and you do a brilliant Instagram account. I don't pay much attention to the other thing, so I'm going to mention Instagram because I follow it. I'm hooked on Instagram. Fucking where you show people nodding out, and then you give commentary of how good their nod is in sort of a sportscaster style, celebrating the nod. Where did you get the idea? When did you start?
Okay, originally I got the idea because I was making addiction content and I had seen another page do something where they were reviewing dirty cups, like cups of lean, you know, and I just thought that was funny. And then it just occurred to me as someone who used to nod, like, oh my God, there are so many influencers who post nods and so many pages that are just dedicated to it. Why is nobody rating these, you know? So at first it just started as a humorous satirical thing. But as time went on and a little community built around it, I kind of started to see that a lot of other addicts related in a way. You know, they were able to get something out of it in the sense of they thought it was funny and it made them feel not so bad about their own past, you know?
Sure. I mean, the nod, for me, nodding was like everything. And everything I did in my life was to try to facilitate how to catch a nod. You know, that was my life. So I think it's a fantastic notion. Now, most of the videos, where do you get them?
Most of the videos, the first half that I did were probably all sent to me by Creatures of New York, which is another Instagram page that I befriended a while ago. But after the first 15 videos, it's just user submissions, either of themselves after they've gotten sober or just other viral clips floating around the internet of people nodding that they sent me.
That is awesome. Have you ever heard of there was this guy, I want to say his name is, I can't believe I can't remember his name. I think his name was Brian, and he was a big Dopey fan, and he started a podcast called The Nod Squad. Did you ever hear of that?
No, I didn't, but you got to link me in with him. That's awesome.
I don't know what happened to him. You know, like he was in and out, and I haven't heard from him. He used to be like a huge like member of our community, but he dipped, totally dipped, and I have not heard anything from him in a million years. But if you ever look, I mean, you know, 7 years, if you look, or 6 years or something like that, if you look up like top addiction podcast, though, his shit still ranks, the Nod Squad, and the Nod God should be on the Nod Squad if the Nod Squad existed. What were you gonna say?
I'll definitely try to reach out. I'm going to look up the Nod Squad because that seems like, you know, two peas in a pod right there.
It all rhymes too. Nod Squad, Nod God, and two peas in a pod.
Yeah, right?
It's a lot of rhyming. Then there's also the Against All Odds pod. Be a whole song about nods and pods and gods and squads. Anyway, when's the first time you got high?
13 years old. I was you know, I was already curious because my father was an addict and I had seen him using off and on throughout my life. But middle school, me and my friends, we found a bag of pills in his brother's room and we didn't even know what they were. That's how uneducated we were. We were just like, oh, cool, pills. And we took them. And, right. You know, they were something because we were unconscious on the floor for a few hours. But that experience led me to my first experience was like pills. And then I started smoking, you know, kind of quickly after smoking and drinking. So 13 is when things started for me.
What kind of addict was your dad?
Amphetamines, meth.
So he was like a serious meth guy and you would see him high all the time?
Yeah, he was in and out of my life a lot. So I'd go, you know, months and months without seeing him. And then he'd reappear for a few months. And like you said, he wouldn't use directly in front of me, but he would be high around me a lot. So his actions were really sporadic.
What about your mom?
My mom is a really sweet woman. She's awesome. She had me when she was 18, so just a young mother, and she did the best job that she possibly could. But it's hard to protect your kids from drugs, you know. It's even if you're a really good mom, sometimes you can't steer them away from that if they're dead set on it.
Well, especially if were your parents together?
No, they weren't. So I was back and forth most of my life, kind of between the two households, like weekends, weekdays kind of thing.
And did your dad just have pills in the house kind of because like anybody that fucks with meth is going to want to be able to come down eventually?
Yeah, he did. But that's actually not where we found the pills originally. We found them in my friend's brother's room.
Tell me the story if you can remember. What was it?
So I was 13 and I was with my friend Dylan. We just got off middle school and we go back to his parents' house. And mind you, I was living in Poway, so a lot of the people there have money. Like they have nice big houses. So it's a big fancy house. And his brother just got sent to rehab and he jokingly was like, we should see if my brother left anything in his room, you know? And at the time, I didn't even really intend to do it. I was kind of just like, yeah, we'll check, you know? But we did. We found a bag of pills. And looking back, they were probably pain pills of some kind. And we took them up and we crushed them up and we snorted them because that's what we thought you did. You were right.
You knew what you were doing. And then from there, you were like, let's drink, let's smoke, let's be these kinds of kids kind of thing.
Yeah, it happened really quick. I mean, I didn't really have a path at that point. You know, a lot of kids were playing sports or into music young, and I was just kind of floating. And so when I found out you could get high, and then I started smoking, it was just a constant thing for me.
Smoking bud.
Yeah.
And, like, was your identity totally, like, bud?
Oh, my God, man. You should have seen my MySpace page. It's, like, so embarrassing. It was, like, weed leaves in the background and Snoop Dogg playing, and I was like 13.
Well, I mean, bud is an amazing thing. I when I fell in love with weed, it was I was so happy to have found it and have it shape my identity. You know, and it's also like I don't smoke weed. I haven't smoked weed in a while, but it's like if somebody could just smoke weed and get on with their life and enjoy marijuana, it's like that seems like a pretty good deal.
Yeah, well, full transparency, because I try to work on this now that I'm in a better direction, I do smoke every once in a while, so I guess I'm not completely sober, as the community would call it, but I haven't touched anything else in about 7 years, so I've been doing good.
So I want to hear your trajectory. Like, you're the stoner kid with the MySpace page, and when do you fucking start getting tattoos?
So that's I'll segue into that through this. So when I turned like 14, me and Jacob meet, right? Or maybe 13.
Is that Jacob fucking what's his face? Jacob Knoll.
Yeah. Yes, Jacob Knoll. He sings for Sublime now, but when we were kids, I met him when I was 13 and he was 12, and we met playing laser tag.
Awesome.
And we really clicked. We both grew up around addiction in our household, and we both smoked. So we started a band together when I was about 15, 16, and we both moved out right when we turned 18, and that's the day I started getting tattooed, the second I turned 18.
And what kind of band did you have with Jacob?
Ska adjacent, definitely. It was really influenced by, like, the Gorillaz, Sublime, obviously. Jake had a lot of, like, metal influences at the time, so we had some heavier songs also.
And what was that like, being from San Diego, California, and your best friend is, like, the prince of, whatever you call it, alternative music, reggae, junky music, and his father is this ridiculous... I mean, ridiculously talented and also, you know, symbol of excess. Like, what does that shape your experience as a teenager at all?
It definitely did. I don't think either of us, when we were really young, had a huge grasp on how influential Sublime was. I knew from my own life because I listened to it, but it wasn't until we got to, like, 15, 16 and started going, like, to shows and parties that people would start coming up and being like, oh my God, you're Jacob Knoll, you know, you got to come back and hang out with us. It definitely got us into a lot of shows, I can say that. Like, we went and saw Slightly Stupid and all those guys a bunch of times.
Well, I told you I got to meet him and interview him when I was in Los Angeles. And I'm a very big Sublime fan, and just I'm very... I think the story is so crazy, like the Bradley Knoll story is so crazy that he died just when that band was exploding and just when Jacob was born. So like all of the fallout from that is, you know, it's very compelling, crazy, sad, but also very inspirational. Now Jacob's playing with Sublime and he seems like he's getting into it because he was nervous. Like when I interviewed him, it was just before Sublime, it started with him. And I could feel him kind of not exactly sure if that's really what he wanted to do. I haven't spoken to him since, but just from the outside, it looks like he's really enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at first, honestly, as we could probably all imagine, like it's very daunting to try to step outside of the shadow of something that's already so big. You know what I mean? And try to take it as your own and take it in a new direction again. And I think that most his anxiety about that was the anxiety most people would have, just kind of taking over such a big project that's a legacy that was your father's and doing it honor. And I think once he started doing it and realized he was capable of doing it in a way that was, you know, really meaningful to him, I think a lot of that anxiety went away and he really came into his own performing for them. Because he's, like you said, he's been killing it. He's been doing a great job.
For sure. And you know, Bradley being this, you know, this kind of like very, very renowned musician and creative, but also heroin addict, how often when you're with Jacob and you're around town, are people wanting to get high with you?
Oh God. When we were young, all the time. Because we gave that energy out, that we were receptive to that, you know? Now, very rarely, every once in a while at a show, someone will come up to us and be like, you guys want to go party? But we just say, nope, we're sober. Thank you, though.
No, but as kids, how did it shape you?
Negatively, definitely. I mean, we had so much access to using more than most people do probably till they're in their 20s when we were teenagers. We had like full access to like everything that you could ever do, even as an adult. And that wasn't good because not only were we addicts at a young age, but we were kids. We had no idea of the long-term effects of doing these kind of things all the time, you know?
So, like, when's the first time, like, you the first drug you did is fucking hard drugs, and then you kind of become stoner drinker guy. When do drugs start creeping in again?
15, we start dabbling with cocaine. You know, mostly at home. Like, I'd go over to Jake's house, and we'd go out to a friend and buy something and just hide in his room. You know, and just kind of hole up. or we'd use one of the various connections, you know, I don't want to name anyone, but just people we knew that were close to us that didn't really have a problem with it at that time. So, it was negative.
When you're kids, are you like, and I mean, is your dad still alive?
He is still alive. He still has addiction problems, but he is still alive.
So when you're kids, both of you with these parent fathers with total addiction, like it's, you know, total addiction, both of you. Your dad was using when you were kids, still using. Jacob's dad dies of it, and you guys are starting to use. Is there ever a talk of, like, we have to be careful?
Yes. There is, many times we make the distinction that I'm never going to do speed, you know, amphetamines, and that he's never going to do opiates. That was like, kind of like the line in the sand that we had, that as long as we didn't cross that, we weren't, you know, repeating mistakes made before, which, you know, was BS because we both crossed that line. No looking back, you know, it just was a matter of time when you're doing that. But yeah, we tried. I mean, we were good friends, so we tried to steer each other in a good direction. But when you're both actively using, it just escalates no matter what.
It's weird. I mean, like, when I started using heavy, like, I knew it was going to be a problem, and I would probably talk. But my parents were middle-class Jewish teachers. They weren't fucking junkies. And I didn't think I was going to become a junkie, but I would say to my friend, like, we can't do this every day, you know, we don't want to get strung out, whatever. But that was without, like, real evidence in front of us. What's the first drug besides Bud that you really fell in love with?
Oh, cocaine.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, when you're 15 and something suddenly takes away all your social anxiety and fear of talking to girls, it's like surreal. It's like, oh my, why didn't anyone show me this before? You know?
It's the answer to all your problems, right?
Yeah. Or at least I felt like it did.
And how are you paying for it? And what are you drinking? What is that?
Coffee.
Cold brew?
Just a iced coffee. I make coffee and then I just let it cool off over the day and just pour it over some ice.
Nice. So like, how would you pay for coke? How would you use it? And how much were you doing?
Well, I think, like a lot of young people who start using, I initially started paying by lying to my family about whatever I was doing to get money.
Classic.
Yeah, you know, going to the movies, we're going to go to an amusement park or something. Just, you know, it, eventually those excuses run out and they start being like, no. You know? But, you know, also, I started working fairly young. I started working around 16, 17, like doing odd moving jobs with my stepdad and stuff. So I had some cash flow, but and mostly just people giving us drugs, to be honest.
Right. And then when do you find yourself feeling like you're an addict?
Oh, I think probably around 20 is when I started having the first visible signs of addiction, to where I had been using off and on, but around 20 is when I started not really playing shows without drinking or doing some yayo. Just my life started to revolve around it. Like, I had to have stuff for before work, after work, and then around 21, I started using speed again while I was in the band with Jake. And man, I ruined my life in like 2 months flat. I completely ruined it.
Well, what instrument did you play?
Bass. I play guitar and bass, but I play bass mostly for bands.
What was it called?
Law. L-A-W.
Nice. I think he mentioned that band to me. You didn't listen. You should listen to the interview with him. I should have made you listen to the interview with him first. But when had you done speed before that?
A few times growing up, with some family friends that were older men in my life who I, you know, trusted and would be doing it from time to time. And one time I just asked when I was like 15, hey, can I try that? And at first they were like, no, but I asked one more time and they said yes. So.
Did you fall in love with speed right away?
I mean, the instant I inhaled it into my lungs, I had like so much euphoria and I didn't even know what to do with myself. So yeah, definitely. I fell in love with it. It was a lot though, because I was so young that when I came off of it, it kind of traumatized me because I was crashing for a few days and I had no context for that experience, you know?
Totally. And when you're 20 and you're starting to be like, maybe this is a little too much, like, would you say uppers were the thing that you loved the most?
At first, uppers are what the first phase of my addiction mostly was, until said time where I got kicked out of the band and was just doing speed all the time, showing up to crazy shows, acting crazy, or just not showing up.
Do you have a good meth story of that period you'd like to share?
Oh my gosh, do I ever. It's a good one. You're going to love this. So I'm sitting there on the couch, and I'm twisting the pizzo, you know, because that's what you do. And I'm just sitting there looking at my phone, and I realize...
Hello. What is twisting the pizzo?
It's when you go 10 to 2 as a little glass pipe.
Twisting the pizzo. God bless you. I used to smoke meth in Southern California, and I never got to hear that expression, so thank you. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, I got you, man. I've always liked that phrasing of it. But so I'm sitting there, and I'm picking at my face, man, like just a true junkie in the moment. And I'm using my phone, the camera, to look at my face, right? And as I'm doing that, I accidentally hit a button and the camera changes. And I'm like, that was weird. Whatever. I put it down. Look at my phone a couple hours later. I was using the Instagram camera.
Oh my God. I posted
myself picking my face on Instagram, and I was so twacked out, I didn't even realize it. Someone called me a few hours later and was like, bro, have you lost your mind? Like, take that down right now.
It's funny because I'm sure you are not the only person to do that. I feel like I've seen videos of people doing that, where in the old days, it seemed like people were less aware of what they were doing, and you might see more of that kind of thing. And so you took it right down?
Yeah, but it had been up for 2 hours, and people messaged me, oh, I already screenshotted it, and I'm like, that's cool. Thanks for that.
How old were you when it happened?
That, I was like 21.
So you were kind of past the point of school bullying possibility.
Yeah, it wasn't a bullying thing, but it was just, you know, just humiliating myself, kind of.
Embarrassing, for sure.
Yeah.
Did you go to college?
I did for a year and a half, but I never graduated because drugs.
Oh, that'll happen, right? So you fall in love with meth. Are you mostly smoking it?
Yeah, pretty much exclusively.
And like, how are you like keeping up with it? How often are you high all the time? Are you up for days on end?
Towards when I got kicked out of the band, yes. But at first,
did they kick you out of the band?
Because Jake. Okay, so this Jake had just gotten sober. We were both trying to get sober, and he got sober first by like 4 or 5 months, right? And through that time, he continuously tried to communicate with me, I need you to be clean. Like, if we're going to be doing this, it's messing me up. You know, I can't be around it. And in my active addiction, I just took that as like, fuck you. You know, I just didn't listen. And after a while, he just kind of asked me, it wasn't even like, you're out. It was like, I can't do this. Can you please stop coming? Like, I need to be able to be clean, and you're coming high every time. And I just was at a point where I just didn't care. I was using a lot, and I just said, okay. You know, so.
Did it break your heart?
Oh, it did, man. Like, I was just like, cool, whatever, I don't care. But I went home and cried. You know, I was devastated. Because I made that band with him when I was, like, 16. And I knew in my heart I was the only person at that moment tearing it down for myself, you know?
Whatever became of Law?
Law went on after I left for about 2 or 3 years with a different group of guys, including Jacob. And then ultimately, the the project was discontinued and now kind of sits as a catalog on Wikipedia and Instagram as like the history of it.
Did Law ever, like, did you guys get a record deal? And would you say, did it make it easier to do drugs, or was it something that tethered you to actual life where you were doing less drugs because you were in it and your addiction exploded after you got kicked out?
When we were in it, we didn't have a record deal, but because of Jake's connections with Sublime, it was kind of irrelevant for us. We had all the opportunities that a record deal would have provided, like big shows, you know, opportunities to sell our album at kind of a larger scale. But while I was in the band, it kept me tethered. Now at this age, I'm in a band again, and it's another thing that keeps me really tethered. I just was young, and I didn't understand addiction at all. I thought it was something I could get away with just on the weekends, smoking a little speed and going crazy as long as I slept Sunday. And so it tethered me, but it also gave me access to a lifestyle I had never lived before. And I got too excited. I got kind of lost in it, I think.
Well, I mean, you're in a band in a place where where your bandmate is, you know, he has the pass like to do it. And it's probably ridiculously exciting, but also a lot of pressure. Because you think you have the world in your hand, right? And it's also your old friend. It's I can imagine what that felt like. And after he kicks you out, he goes on. And how do you deal with it?
So I moved to Orange County to Dana Point right when I leave the band. I had a friend that just was moving there, and he had some more money accessible, and he was like, "Do you want to move in?" And I was like, "Sure," because I was moving out of Long Beach, my apartment. So I went down there, and I made a really close group of friends. You know, I know it seems odd, but I guess I was so broken down from leaving the band that in that year that I first moved, I made this group of guys of friends that were really close, and we all partied together also. So. Not much changed in that area, but it helped me to refocus and recenter myself because the band was my identity. It was what I did from 16 to 22. So it definitely took some time to refocus myself.
And but you were saying that was the first iteration of your addiction. So where does the second iteration start?
The second iteration is what I would call the serious addiction, where the things happen to people that usually happen far along the line. So I moved to Orange County, and I become best friends with this guy named Robert, who was 2 years older than me. So I was 22, he was 24 or 25. And he was an incredible dude. He was really sweet, he was a rapper, and he introduced me to Orange County. But like me and Jake, he had a history of partying, and me and him went down a very long, dark path of selling coke, doing coke and selling it with a couple other friends, and then speed eventually. And that's when I started going to jail and stuff. That's when my first encounters with, like, you know, getting in legal trouble started popping up for the most part.
What happened?
Well, I had been using for about 2 years, from 22 to 24, I was living there, using, selling, partying, just kind of living life like it was a big party. I was,
Feel free to tell story after story. That's the greatest.
Okay, awesome. So I'm friends with this guy, Robert, and this other guy, Fred, and this other guy, Austin. We're like this unit of like best friends there. And we're just, we hang out in San Clemente a lot at this place called The Triangle. It's these three bars, Oli's Tavern, Fox's, and this one other. And we were just pretty much there every night partying, but also selling blow, you know, because this was 2015-16 where people were paying $80, $100 for a gram, you know. So we were making a ton of money, mostly just with our friends, though, you know, mostly just with our friends. And that's when we started getting into Oxy. And that really took a sharp turn because we start doing the pills, you know, to kind of manage the come down and the blow. We'd go out, party all night and do the pills. And we started getting addicted to the pills, and then fentanyl started getting in the pills, you know?
When's the first, I mean, you said the first drug you did was painkillers, opiates back in the day. When's the first time Oxy show up on Dana Point?
Probably about a year after I moved there. So like 2016, kind of 2016-ish. I'm starting to see a lot of people like, oh, I got these blues. I got these blues. I start seeing that word thrown around all the time.
And were you using a lot of coke because you're selling a lot of coke?
It's the opposite. I was selling coke because I was using a lot of coke in reality. Every dollar that I made went back into my habit. I never once walked away with money.
No, I get it. Okay, I get it. And when do you fall in love with the blues?
Right. So I've been doing coke pretty consistently from like, you know, 20 to 20, 23, 24. And I start burning my nervous system out. So when I go out, I start doing it and not feeling good. I start having anxiety. I start feeling like, you know, kind of sick in a weird way by the end of the night that I had never felt before. And that's when I really started loving the blues, because I realized, oh, I can do a little bit of blow and then snort half a blue and no consequences, so I thought. You know, so that's kind of when that ramped up, definitely.
And, like, do you fall into deep opiate addiction at that time?
Yeah, so I had the next 2 years from, like, 22 to 24 pretty much was just an increasingly ramp up of opiates. So it started with, you know, the blues, the regular 30 milligram pills. And then there were the fentanyl pills, which I didn't do on purpose. That just started being circulated.
Sure.
And then I couldn't afford those, so I started buying heroin. And then I realized that it was still kind of cheaper just to buy the fentanyl pills. And I just kind of lived in like a cycle of that for 2 years until one morning my friend Robert, who had been the person that kind of brought me into Orange County and introduced me to everybody and really took care of me out there, he passed away. He overdosed.
Was it fentanyl?
Yeah, he thought he was just taking a blue. I was with him and we were partying, and I had just realized I started wanting to get clean, because the last 2 years had just been cocaine, meth, and blues, you know. And we had been up till 2 a.m, and I said, you know, I'm going to go home. I'm not feeling good. So I leave and wake up at about 7 a.m. to his girlfriend just blowing my phone up. And she's just saying, Robert's dead. Robert's dead. And I didn't even believe her, because I was just with him. I was in shock. And so I jump in my car and drive up. And sure enough, the ambulance had taken him away and he had an overdose and he passed away.
And were you doing the same pills that he was doing?
Yeah.
And how was he using them?
I don't know when I left what he did, but in general, we were snorting little parts of them or popping half of them, you know?
So you weren't shooting them and you weren't smoking them. You were snorting them or eating them.
Yeah, I had shot in my own time with some other separate people a handful of times, but it wasn't a daily thing. It wasn't a part of what we always did, no.
Sorry about your friend. It's like that just seems to be the story whenever there's fentanyl around and fentanyl pills. And it's always like, I never did fentanyl. Like, I got sober before fentanyl was around. And it's what killed Chris, who started the show with me. And we always talked about, he always would say how he wished he had tried it. And then after he died and the show, excuse me, got more popular and stuff, everybody would say the same thing to me, which is like, why would people use fentanyl if it kills you? And me not being a fentanyl user, like, I would just say, well, I'm sure most people don't die from fentanyl. Oh, and they like it. You know, as a fentanyl user out there, like, when everyone's dying around you, how are you dealing with it?
I got, but it made me get sober. I lost Robert, a cousin, and then three other friends in 2 months, all from fentanyl. And it kind of made me have a mental breakdown. I'm going to be 100% honest. Like, I kind of lost my mind for a little bit. And I realized that that was going to be me next. And that not only that, that half the people I'd spent the last couple years with were no longer there. And I called my grandma crying, and I said, I need to check into a hospital right now. Like, this is it for me. I need to check into a hospital and get help. And I drove down to her house, completely high out of my mind, and she drove me to the San Diego hospital, and I had to get, like, Medi-Cal. I had to tell them I was at risk of hurting myself to get instant Medi-Cal. In California, they'll give you temporary 10-day Medi-Cal if you say that, so you can get into a treatment center.
And that was it? That's how you got better?
Yeah. Robert passing away, and then my cousin and the other people passing away right after. It was too much. I had lost my band and this whole new friend group that I made that was like my new identity, all gone. Like, almost overnight, it felt like, you know?
So sad. And, but it's a miracle that it had that effect on you. Like, that's the one upside of any, because, you know, the old kind of street story is when you hear about somebody dying, all of the addicts want to do that drug because it's so strong. But in your situation, your friend died and you were like, fuck this. Were you scared? Were you just, I mean, you said you were in shock. What was, describe the feelings, please.
I felt like the little light inside my heart that kind of guides me towards like being a decent person and living life in a way I can accept was fading when my friend died. And I felt it wasn't so much fear of dying, more so fear of, I felt like I was losing myself completely. Like I had no morals that, I had morals, but I wasn't acting on them, you know? Like a good friend would have talked to their friends first and been like, hey, you guys have been using a lot, you know? Or, hey, you seem depressed. And it made me reevaluate how I got to where I was in my life, and that maybe I needed to start being a better person myself and making better choices for myself.
Do you think, like, were they using heavier than you were when they died?
No, I was.
Yeah, so why would you have thought to ask them when no? I mean, like, you're deep in the throes of addiction. Like, there was no way you were going to ask them.
Like, no, and I know that now, you know. But at the time, it really weighed heavily on my conscience that I didn't. I had that kind of survivor's guilt of.
Sure.
Why didn't, you know? I knew it was a problem. Why didn't I say anything? But like you said, I was in it myself. You know, I was deeper in it.
So where do you check in?
It's the hospital in San Diego. What is it called? It'll come to me in a sec, but it's just a hospital in San Diego.
And you go detox there?
Yeah, I do medical detox, and I'm there for 2 weeks, grueling 2 weeks, where they end up putting me on methadone, which is the last chapter of my addiction. So I'm there for 2 weeks, and then I was at a recovery home, like a state-funded one, for 2 weeks. And then I moved in with my mom for a bit. And my first 4 years getting clean were a big haze because I was on methadone. I've only been off of methadone for a year and a half.
Nice.
So they started me at 100 milligrams because of the amount that I had been using, yeah. You know, and man, that was hard to stop, David. Like, out of everything, when I quit the methadone, bro, like, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
No, I was on methadone for a long time, so I know what that feels like getting off of methadone. And I know for me, when I got off, I was at like 140, 150 milligrams, also in Southern California. It took me a year to get off. And when I got off of it, I was so excited to be off of it. And I mean, I wound up doing drugs again, but I never wound
I'm doing methadone again. How did you get off?
So I had been on it for, let's see, get sober at 24. I'd been on it for about 4 or 5 years, so I'm heading towards 29. I'm 31 now, by the way, just for context. And I just start to I kind of just have this epiphany that I'm seeing a therapist, so it's not like I just have this on my own. You know, I'm doing a lot of work to try to better myself, talking to a therapist, and I realized that I'm never going to turn the corner that I want to turn if I'm on methadone for the rest of my life. So which is just like, to feel a part of the world.
What was the dosage you were on?
100.
You just stayed at 100. You didn't go up.
No, I just stayed at 100, yeah.
And you're on for 4 years. And during that time, were you using anything else, or would you just go to the clinic every day and get your whatever, drink it?
Just, I think maybe one time in that 4 years, I drank one time. I went out with some old friends, and I thought, like, maybe I could just have a beer. But I felt so sick to my stomach, probably from the methadone and drinking, that it actually completely scared me away from ever attempting that again. So for the most part, yeah, I was. It was just the methadone.
And no pills, no coke, no speed, no nothing.
Nothing. No. I have not done any of that since 24 when I first got off of the big stuff, the big three or whatever.
Do you think it was because you felt just so traumatized by your friend's death? Do you think that's what did it?
Yeah, that was the final needle in the haystack. My whole life had been drugs. My dad was an addict. Ever since I was born, it had been what had been holding me back. I never had my dad in my life, or when I did, he was, I hate to say the word abusive because it kind of implies someone physically hurts you, but he wasn't a great dad. He wasn't abusive, but he wasn't a great dad. He did a lot more harm than good. And then as a teenager, I used, and then I joined this band and I used, and then I make these new friends and I use, and they die. And it was just, you got to be pretty fucking thick to not start after 30 years of something to not start seeing, okay, like, this is ruining my life. You know,
I just got sober when I was 41, you know, and nobody had died. You know, no, for me, nobody in my circle had died, and I was just lonely, and I had a kid and everything, you know, in that way, it was like, I was like, enough's enough. But I could imagine like the deaths being the thing that push you over the edge. How did you get off the methadone, and how would you advise someone to get off the methadone?
I would advise, unless you're a fucking psychopath, to taper. I would advise to taper. I would do every see what you can do with your body, but generally like every 2 weeks to a month, drop another like 2 to 4 milligrams, depending on how fast you can go. And keep that pace, but if you feel too sick, stop. Because I didn't stop, because I'm kind of like cuckoo determined about stuff sometimes. And I kept scaling down, and I got to a point where I was like really not mentally well because I was not giving myself a break on the dose downs.
You just were like 4 milligrams a week or something. How long did it take to go from 100 to off?
Like a year, because I had a lot of little breaks, a lot of little pauses after like after I got to 20, it took me longer because I started feeling,
right? At 20, it's scary to like walk away.
Yeah, because I'm like, oh shit, like, I'm here. I'm going to be off soon, you know? But then I went to 4 milligrams kind of pretty quick from 20 after, over like 3 or 4 months, and then I just stopped right at 4.
And you didn't go in, and you didn't take anything else, and that was it?
Yeah, I told my grandma, I live with my grandma, who's been amazingly supportive of my recovery, by the way, and my channel. And I just told her I'm going to be really uncomfortable for a few weeks probably. And it wasn't as bad as I thought, the actual getting off. But the taper process, the whole going from 100 down, it's like being in this like uncomfortable fog for a year. At least for me. That was my experience with it.
Did you smoke weed after the taper or no?
Yes, I did. That's kind of where I started smoking again. Not blaming my therapist, but I have a therapist, and I told her my relationship with weed. She knows all about my addiction. And I said, you know, I've been smoking from time to time, and it's been really helping. And she told me, that's okay. As long as you're not doing anything else, and as long as you're able to maintain yourself, you know, it's not the end of the world. And I think it really depends on your relationship. On your relationship with it. Like, I myself, I've been able to every once in a while smoke a little and not constantly smoke, you know, not feel like I need to always be smoking or anything.
I know when I got off methadone, I needed weed, like I needed it, and I was so happy to have it. When I got off benzos and methadone at the same time.
Oh my God,
dude. I was so happy to have bud. And It's funny how that is. I think all that it comes down to is quality of life. Like, if you could have a great quality of life and smoke bud, fantastic. If you can have a great quality of life and do heroin, good for you. Like, it's all about like where your quality of life is. When you get off the methadone, you start smoking bud, you're in therapy, no meetings.
No, I did meetings when I very first got sober and started the methadone. I did like 6 months of meetings, and I had a hard time connecting with people. I think because of the methadone, in all honesty, my emotional connecting points just weren't there, and I just kind of felt like I wasn't getting anything out of it. But so many people get so much help from it. So I hesitate to even say that because I don't want to shy people away. It works for a ton of people.
Well, there's a mess of people that listen, that go to meetings. There's a mess of people that go, like, that go to AA, that go to NA, that do Dharma, that do nothing. Like, Dopey Nation does a Zoom thing. They do 25 meetings a week where they just do this kind of non-denominational recovery Zoom, where, you know, people might smoke weed or people might not be working 12-step. Or it's like the idea is community. The idea is being able to talk to people. I mean, that I think is the best thing about any kind of fellowship is being in the same boat with other people. And it sounds like you're getting a lot of community just from your page, from your channel.
Now, yeah, that's been like, you know, I've had people ask me like, oh, did you start this channel to bring awareness to addiction? And I think it would be a flagrant lie for me to say yes, because I did not start it in any kind of like altruistic, ambitious, like I'm going to show people the reality. But I will say that as the community did build, it's changed the way I look at the content and the way I make things. So like my next content journey is going to be doing interviews with people, recovering addicts that are like satirical interviews that have a really funny twist to them, because yeah, like, you know, you see people, you see other addicts and you start to feel like, okay, like there are other things I can do with this other than just like surface level jokes about our condition. You know, I might be able to really talk to people. And that to me is like a big dream. I've always wanted to be able to connect and to know people, and it's, you know, it's what life's all about.
Yeah, I think you just described exactly the way I feel about what I get to do, in that it was never meant to be altruistic in any way. And it was just meant to be fun. And then also all the like self-centered greed and, you know, fame and all that prestige. Like, Chris and I wanted all that. I still enjoy all that. But when we can be altruistic, and when we can actually help somebody, it feels good. It's funny though, like, because you saw our Instagram page just got taken down and it got put back up. But I had this lady who was, and we had this woman who was doing it for me. I was paying her to run our social media, and she always suggested having you on the show. And I was like, okay. And then we started talking and we figured it out. But when the page got taken down, she was sure it was because somebody, some meme person, you know what I mean? Some junkie meme person put something up. It was a meme about smoking weed, kicking opiates. All right. And it was like some meme saying it wasn't good. Like, weed doesn't help kicking idiots. And it was like the meme was like the dude was like tweaked out or bugged out from like it wasn't a good mix. And I think I wrote in the comments, I found weed very helpful when I was kicking opiates. And the woman was like, they definitely flagged you for that because you said weed is helpful or whatever. So like, what have you, like, when did you get so involved with this junkie Instagram business?
Right at the start of 2025, I decided I was going to start taking Instagram more seriously. I had been working on it a few months before, but like I said, I saw Jimmy's content, and that was the first time I ever saw someone's content, and I felt like, this is hilarious, and I feel like I could do something similar to this. You know, I'd always been a troll and a jokester within my friend group. So I start making these little funny skits where I'm using props, like how he did. Like I had fake cocaine, and I was like, if he doesn't get you this on Valentine's Day, he's not a real man, kind of thing. Like kind of like baiting a little, and it did well. It got millions of views, but then it got flagged and taken down. Then I had another post flagged and taken down.
Why did it get flagged and taken down? They just took down another one of mine, too.
They always give, like, the same bullshit excuse, which is that, like, I'm promoting either unhealthy behavior or the possible sale of narcotics.
Me, too. So what do you do about that?
I made a new account. That's why I made Naughty God, because Real Bad Wolf got striked and then it got flagged and I couldn't go. My page was shadow banned for like a month, basically. I couldn't.
How big was Real Bad Wolf?
Only 12,000 followers. Not huge.
How long did it take to build Naughty God up?
I've had that account for 3 months.
That's crazy. How did it do so well so fast?
Honestly, it's a little crazy to me, too. Like, I have posts that have gotten me like 5,000 to 10,000 followers just from single posts. I think it was just a new concept. Like the nodding thing has been so hot on the internet. You got Ollie B, Jake Scowley, a bunch of other people doing it, and I think it was like the perfect time to come in as an arbitrator, like rating these things. You know, people were just like, "What the fuck is this? I'm gonna follow."
When did you get the idea?
Probably 4 months ago. I put it into action like right when I had the idea. I was like, I gotta do this.
Tell me the whole story of where the idea of rating nods comes from.
So I was looking at channels that were doing really well, and the theme that I saw consistently was that they have a format of a TV show. Like, they drop episodes of something that are reoccurring so that when people see it, they are like, I don't want to miss the next one and follow. And so I just was brainstorming what I could do in my world like that. And that's when I saw the Dirty Cola account, who is permanently banned now for the exact same stuff we're talking about. He was rating cups of lean. And it was so simple, just like 7 out of 10, too dirty, looks gross, you know, or whatever. He'd say he's funnier than that, but he'd say some funny shit. And instantly when I saw that, my first thought was like, someone's got to rate nods because like, people are just nodding everywhere nowadays, you know?
Such a good idea. I'm trying to figure out, like, what the fuck am I going to do on this stupid social media? I started posting man in the street videos that are doing a bit better. I just, you know, like, I didn't know what to do. I like your concept of trying to do, like, a TV show where each post is a bit of a TV show. I like that idea. What do you think I should do, Naughty God? What do you think I should do?
I would take the format that you're already using and pre-work with people to ask really abrasive or funny questions and then clip those for Instagram. So it's kind of what you already do, just going through the funniest bits of your clips, or if you want to start something. You kind of have an endless gold mine because you're constantly talking to addicts. So I would just choose like a couple topics and format those show, like the show of a topic. So like you can have one where you're talking about, like you talk about recovery, right? You could have a specific episode just talking about relapse, like the relapse episode, you know? And that's just like the theme of that running chains of episodes. But that's just one idea. You just got to take a theme and run with it for a while.
I like that idea. When's the last time you nodded?
Yeah. Like 24 years old, right before I got sober.
How important was nodding to you?
Oh my God, it was my whole life. If I couldn't have a good nod at the end of the day, I couldn't sleep.
What did you do? Because I know for me, right, I needed to nod. I didn't want to do, I was shooting heroin, and if I didn't nod, it was like, what's the point of shooting heroin? And the things that I would do to nod, personally, I would read comics, that would make me nod. I would play guitar, that would always make me nod. I'd watch TV, and I'd smoke cigarettes. And I did those over and over again. I'd read comics, I'd play guitar, I'd watch TV, and smoke cigarettes. And I would always nod out. What would you do to get a good nod?
That's, first off, that's such a relatable loop. I love that. Really similar. I would smoke cigarettes, I'd watch anime, and I'd play guitar or play on my phone. Pretty much exactly the same. Now, mind you, when fentanyl came around, it only takes a little bump of that to get nodded. I mean, you crush half of one of those and snort it, and within 2 minutes, you're, huh? You know?
When everybody's saying that fentanyl doesn't have legs, what do they mean?
I'm assuming they mean it doesn't keep you high for very long.
I think so. But do you find that to be your experience with it versus oxys or heroin?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You find yourself within 15 or 20 minutes having that feeling of craving coming in again. Versus oxy, you can go a couple hours, you know, 2 hours if you're lucky.
I feel like if we get to make a dopey TV show, like a real TV show, you could be like the nod commentator. And we'd be like, now we're going to go to the Naughty God rating nods.
Oh, I would love that. I have a whole list of phrases I've created, you know, like some of them I haven't created, I've appropriated, like Charm City Rainbow, Boston Street Shuffle.
Wait, what's I got the all Charm the terms City, ready. What's the Charm City Rainbow? Go through some of these things. What's the Charm City Rainbow?
So the Charm City Rainbow is, in my world, is a kind of a offshoot of the horseshoe. So the horseshoe, I'm just going to give you a little example. The horseshoe, just like a classic yeah. position. And the Charm City Rainbow is when they start getting like a slant to it. You know what I mean? Like start stepping over to the side. But we got the nod walk shuffle, which is when you're nodding, moving forward. You know how some people nod and they're still moving somehow?
Yeah.
The nod walk shuffle. Baltimore Street Yoga. One of my favorite terms.
Did you invent that?
No, definitely not. A lot of these I get messaged or they're in the comments and I'm just like, that's fucking hilarious. And I just write it down. I have made some of them like nod enhancing drugs, Osama bin Nodden, you know, little terms like that.
What about Sheriff of Nottingham?
Sheriff of Nottingham. That was like a double thing. I had already came up with the Nottingham thing, and then a bunch of people were like, Sheriff of Nottingham, Sheriff of Nottingham. I have the Prince and Princess of Nottingham. Nodvocados. Yeah, these are ridiculous.
What Nod else? What else?
The Scarecrow.
Wait, hold on. What makes somebody the Scarecrow?
Oh, man. The Scarecrow is when they're just like...
You see, I feel like I'm not even a real drug addict because I was never fucking nodding standing up. I was certainly never nodding like walking around the city. Like that was, you never found me nodding and walking at the same time.
Well, look, when I was younger and I shot H maybe like 5 or 10 times. That was like a pure nod. Like you do it, you sit there and you're you know, you're like melt. But Fetty is a little different. Fetty gives you these like energetic nods where you're like you're the part of your brain that like moves doesn't turn off, but everything else does.
So what does that look like?
it looks like what you see in my videos, basically. Just people, you know, like this. Go on.
So it's like serious zombie business.
Yeah, like serious zombie business. Like all the way to the ground, snapping back up.
What are you like, what was I going to ask? Is, in your opinion, is heroin ever going to come back or is it over?
It's hard to say. I think it's kind of like, no, it probably won't, but more because of capitalism than because of anything else.
Of course.
Like, and when I say that, I mean like the profit margins like just aren't there anymore, like compared to, you know, these big groups selling, like cartels and stuff selling fentanyl and stuff. They can mass produce this stuff in small labs and, you know, ship it out for millions and millions of dollars. The process is a lot cheaper and more accessible for them, to my understanding. So I think as long as that's happening, probably not, you know.
It makes you wonder, though, like, what are the poppy growers doing? Like, are they selling it exclusive to the super wealthy who are feeling safer about doing heroin than fentanyl? Does it make heroin much more expensive because fentanyl is everywhere else? Do you know anything about this?
My understanding is that fentanyl has made its way into heroin.
Right. But it's like, if you think about it, though, like, I'm sure, did you see the movie Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
You know where you have that character, the Eric Stoltz character, who's got the three different kinds of heroin, and he's describing each of them. And
kind
of
white.
Right, the madman, the one that's like, whatever, $200 a gram or whatever. I don't remember the price. But it makes you think that a heroin maker is going to, who has the really, really, really pure heroin, to not add fentanyl, because there isn't any heroin, wouldn't that make it like more attractive and almost like some like bougie product, like that isn't like a street product? It's only the most premium product.
I'm sure if you're in Hollywood and you have enough money, all those things are a reality. You know, I'm sure that there is a guy who does exactly what you're saying, who's the fucking best at his job. I just don't know him.
I wonder, though. I would love to know about, like, what, I mean, I'm interested in recovery. I love recovery, but I'm also interested in the economics of the drug world. And if fentanyl has supplanted all heroin, like, what happened to the poppy farmers? What happened to the heroin makers?
You know, the great irony is that they're probably just selling to pharmaceutical companies now.
That is a great irony. And what other junkie and recovery pages do you love? Like, who are your favorites?
I follow you. I follow, you know, Jimmy, who am you? Regret Maxing is a meme page, but he's actually a recovering addict as well, who a lot of his content is adjacent to a lot of the stuff we talk about. And then Dirty Cola, but his page got completely taken down.
Did you know him?
In the way we know each other, yeah. Like, we had a rapport and we talked and we were friends online and stuff.
Did you ever get to talk to him after his page went down?
Yeah, I have his number. He had been dealing with this for a while off and on, and he pretty much said, I'm done. He has a degree in graphic marketing or graphic design, so he's just pursuing the real life stuff now.
What do you do for real life stuff?
I do a couple things. Very humbly drive Uber, but I drive Uber sometimes, but I also mix and master music. So I mix and master projects for people. But recently, most of my finances have been just, I've been kind of burning through savings recently, just trying to build this new channel. So I'm going to have to start doing a little bit more groundwork here soon.
Music or no?
Yeah. I make money from music, but I'm in a band.
I mean, are you playing? Forget about money. Like, are you playing? Are you having fun making music?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. I just played Warped Tour last weekend on Saturday.
What's the band called?
Somehow Unseen.
Awesome.
And what? Yeah, we're on Instagram, everything.
You play bass in the band?
Yeah, I play bass and I mix and master the music.
Sick. All right, Dakota, this has been a lot of fun. If you ever want to make a dopey song, I'll totally play it.
Dude, we could totally whip something up like that.
All right, cool, man. And people could find you. Where can they find you? Naughty God on Instagram. Is it Naughty God everywhere?
Yeah, on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Naughty God, and my band is Somehow Unseen.
Awesome. And then would you be so kind, and thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and would you ever collab with me on a reel?
Absolutely, 100%.
So let's pick one. Pick one and let's do it.
Okay, you want me to make one, or do you want to do it out of this episode?
No, I want to do one of your naughty ones.
Oh, yes, no problem. Absolutely.
Because I think that the content is really perfect for us.
Yeah, I'll message you, I'll text you beforehand and show you what I was going to collab, and then you can say yes or no.
Because you're like a commentator, right? Like you're a nod commentator, and maybe you could be like, what's up? You know, what do you call your audience?
The Naudience.
Great. What's up, Naudience? And I want to, like, you could do something like where you welcome the Dopey Nation to the Naudience, and then you'll probably get like some crossover, and it'll be a lot of fun.
I'm writing this down. Dopey Nation Naughty Intro.
And we might be doing another show in Los Angeles in January, so you have to come if we do.
Oh, absolutely. Last time I didn't even know about it till like the day of. I was kind of bummed because I totally would have loved to come and see it all.
It was a disaster, but next time you should come. It'll be cool.
I'll definitely be there for sure. Unless I'm like out of the state for a show, I will be there for sure.
All right. Well, I appreciate coming through, Dakota. And if you need anything from me, just let me know.
Yeah, thanks so much, David. It's been awesome talking on the Dopey Podcast, and have a great day.
You too, man. Thanks. Okay, that's me and Naughty God. I have a lot of belief that good things are coming to Naughty God. I believe good things are going to happen for Naughty God. I cannot wait to hear your guys' opinion of our first Wednesday dose of Dopey. I just want to say, anybody listening that's using and worried about dying, please check out Safe Spot. Call them up at 1-800-972-0590. The idea is you get your drugs, you get your fentanyl or your heroin or your crack or your meth or your benzos or whatever. People are worried about fentanyl and weed now too. But whatever you get, if you're afraid of dying, call 1-800-972-0590 while you're using, and the people at SafeSpot will look out for you. 1-800-972-0590. Please call them up if you are worried about dying. And if you're worried about getting sober, go to a meeting and call them up because they're great. We love Kimber and Steven and Jesse and the SafeSpot crew. And then if you want stickers, go to customstickers.com. Customstickers.com makes all of our stickers. They make them quickly. They make them in super high quality fashion. If you want to save 20%, use the code DOPEY20. I hope you had fun on our first ever Wednesday dose of Dopey. Please send in emails and voicemails. If you think you would be an amazing Dopey guest, send in an email or a voicemail and let me know why. Anyway, thank you, and until we meet again, stay strong, Dopey Nation, and fucking toodles for Chris.